Welcome to the second in my series of nostalgia interviews. My guest this week is Paul March Russell, who teaches comparative literature at the University of Kent. And science fiction is very much an area that Paul specialises in. Paul talks about his earliest memories. We learn how television played a role in shaping his identity. We discuss the pitfalls of going back to one's childhood home and about how Paul followed a path in academia, but that it wasn't where he necessarily thought he would end up. We talk about Doctor Who, John Peel, Mini Pops, regrets about how he voted in the 1992 general election, and towards the end of the interview, Paul reflects on the role that religion has played in shaping his values and goals. So join me for the second in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. My guest this week is Paul March Russell. Well, we now have the second of the nostalgia interviews, and I'm delighted to actually be with someone this afternoon who I think has been at Kent longer than me. It's Paul March Russell. I don't know if you just want to say a little bit about yourself.
I probably have been here longer than you. I did my master's here in Kent in 1934. Then I stayed on because I got British Academy funding to do a PhD. So I did that for the rest of the 90s. Then I went away, then I came back in 2001, and although I've not always been here in Seckle, I've been here at Kent since then.
Yeah. But what was your first degree in?
My first degree was in English Studies and History at Oxford Brookes University.
Yeah, and then you came to Seckle to do your Master's in...?
I did my Master's with the School of English. Yeah. There was MA in Modern Literature since 1850, and then I did a PhD on the modernist short story, again in the School of English.
Fantastic. And so, yeah, we've known each other, and also, and I'm sure we'll come to this in a minute, but of course, I don't know how you would characterise yourself, but I always, when I see you, I think science fiction.
Yes, people do tend to think of me as a sci-fi guy. We never say sci-fi in the science fiction world, we always say science fiction.
I had a student a few years ago, I think we may actually be mutual friends on Facebook, and he was always saying that whenever he went to your classes, he'd ask you like for a reading list, and he'd come away with tons of material.
Yes.
And to be fair to you as well, actually, with the nostalgia interest, you were digging out all sorts of things for me. So no doubt, you know, the nostalgia. You know, we're talking in a nostalgia interview, but I know that nostalgia does come into your work to an extent, or at least there's certainly a crossover.
Yeah. Certainly ideas about memory and history and cultural memory.
Yeah. No, that's wonderful. Anyway, so a bit about a wider background. So I think you're from Kent originally.
I'm from Kent. I'm from Gillingham, so in the Medway Towns. So I was born there eons ago, and that's where I grew up, and that's why I lived until I moved to Oxford for my undergraduate degree, and I came back to live in Gillingham again whilst I was doing my PhD and so forth. So I've always been a Kent person.
You see, that's nostalgia in itself, that sense of going back, you know, actually, back to your place of origin. Actually, even in my case, I know my family are from Cardiff, but in recent years, my parents moved to Herefordshire, sort of near Worcester, to the part of the world where my mother's father was from. And that sense of sort of going back to where your roots are, even if it's not your own home, it's, you know, the family connections, I think.
Yeah, I mean...
You know, in retirement, actually tend to be, for a lot of people, I find, really quite pressing.
Yeah, I've kind of, have to be said, when I moved from Gillingham, I've never been back. Nevertheless, I have occasionally thought about taking my children back to, oh yeah, this is where I lived, and that's where I went to school, and so on. And then good sense prevails, and I don't do that. But nevertheless, there is a sort of occasional thing there, yeah.
But you don't want this. Was it the Piers Morgan thing a few years ago when he interviewed Cliff Richard and went back to Cliff Richard's home? Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, Cliff Richard now lives in somewhere very palatial in Barbados or somewhere. Yeah. And he went back to his home, which was quite modest.
Yes.
And it was rather odd because the house clearly, well, the way he was presenting it was as if, you know, it hadn't changed in 60 years. It was like, oh yeah, this is the cupboard. You know, there were so many of us, we had to sort of sleep, you know. It was like five to a room. And, you know, this was the cupboard where my sister slept with me. Very odd, but I agree with you. I find going back to one's hometown bittersweet. You obviously,
yes.
That's a word I kind of put in deliberately. I went back to Cardiff recently, which is where I'm from, and to the streets where I was born, and it played havoc with my memories for a start, because there was that sense of, hang on a minute, you know, when I was last here I was four, so where are my friends? You know, why are they not coming out to play?
Yeah.
But also that the sense of space, yes, and what, when you're really small, seems huge when you're in your 40s.
That's true. I mean, I before I left Gillingham, I think myself and my brother actually went back to our junior school and had a look around there. Loud in, and suddenly, yes, yeah, so obviously, yeah, suddenly stairs, it seemed very large, we're now actually quite small, and so on. Equally, when I go back to Oxford, Oxford has radically changed since I was undergraduate, because when we were in Oxford in the early 90s, we had all the wonderful congestion around Carfax, and you could just sort of walk brazenly in between cars and sort of go, ha ha ha, you know, you can't run me over. And now, of course, it's all been totally pedestrianised, and it's actually really quite flat and ugly and bare, actually, Oxford High Street. It's not great, actually, yeah, in comparison. So.
Yeah, Cardiff's gone the same way. I think it's St Mary Street, which has been significantly pedestrianised. Also, I remember going to Swansea, probably around the mid-90s, and not quite on the scale of New York, where you literally have, like, you know, the motorway running through the city, but Swansea had a, you know, through the centre near what's now the, I think it's the Quadrant, you know, a significantly, you know, big, you know, area where the traffic was going at speed, and yeah, and when you've got those sort of memories, sometimes you go back to a place. I always do think it's the people who make the place. That's the crucial thing. You the people, the absence of the people that you associate with a place, when they're not there, that does impact on you. You know, I'm in two minds. I'm going back to the place where I went to university, to Lampeter, for my reunion in July of this year. And it's taken me decades to feel comfortable with going back. And I think it's only because I've reconnected with friends on social media who will be going back that I feel it's a trip worth making. Otherwise, I think that it would cloud and quite possibly distort my memories.
So here I get to ask you a question. So do those friends, do they become like coordinates for which you can sort of place yourself, as were, in the kind of geography of your mind, as it were?
Yeah, well, I tried it out, because when I went to Cardiff recently, it was to meet old Lampeter University friends, and so the place was different. In some cases, people that there is no... I mean, I'm from Cardiff originally, but I don't associate them with Cardiff at all. They just happen to be living there now in some cases. But what I found is that in meeting them again, it was as if I was just stepping back into almost like the conversations that we had 25 years ago. So for me, particularly when I'm looking at nostalgia, I really do think it's the people, the emotions that matter far more than the bricks and mortar.
Yeah.
The bricks and mortar is part of it. So going back to Lambert will be the full hog, because it'll be the people in the same place, but
so
obviously
you
25 years on.
Kind of set up like effective memories to kind of anchor yourself.
And for me, it's very clearly people oriented. If it wasn't for the fact that I'd almost tested the water to see if we have enough in common, you know, because there is that scenario that you reconnect with people and actually find that you've got nothing in common with them. You think, well, what did I see in you all those years ago? So it's the anticipation that maybe whatever our circumstances are, people have families, you know, married, divorced, all sorts of scenarios, all sorts of things, jobs, all sorts of ambitions realised or thwarted. What we have in common is this sense that at a particular time, we all bonded because we had a similar mindset, and it remains to be seen, obviously, whether all those connections, all those similarities, have actually sustained, you know, through the decades since. Yeah. Have you kept in touch with many friends from university?
No, not particularly, I have to say. No, not at all. Actually, I had a friendship for quite a while with one person from my undergraduate days, and then life changes, and you know, and her situation kind of led us sort of separating, and you know, sort of correspondence became less, as it were, so it kind of rather drifted apart, really. I was in touch with my best friend from school, where he sort of popped out of nowhere on Facebook, and so we were sort of you know, chatting away on Facebook for a while until he then left Facebook. So you know, it's been a bit intermittent and a bit broken, actually, but yeah.
Yeah, I think the expression "never say never." I spent years trying to trace some of the people. I'd come across old photographs and think, you know, really want to know what they're up to. But then through social media, you then find not just what they're up to, as in What job do they have?
Yeah.
But actually, you know what they do day to day. You know, and you know, people. I've got a number of Facebook friends who will talk about going to chapel, or they talk about the specifics of their day to day jobs and which supermarkets they go to and the frustrating encounters they have when they're standing in queues. And you suddenly realise it's the nitty gritty of people's lives, which I guess is also the connection that you forge. You know, you meet people in a. I found particularly in Lampeter, because it was so small. There were a lot of people, and I include myself in this, maybe slightly eccentric, I don't know, but people who seemed larger than life because the town was quite small.
Yeah.
And maybe if I'd gone to, I don't know, Canterbury or certainly to London, Oxford even, maybe people would have been sort of somewhat more dispersed, or they wouldn't have made the same sort of impact.
Yeah,
and I think that's part of it as well. A small town where people are there because they chose to go there to study, but they may be from Scotland, they may be from anywhere in the world. And I have many friends actually from London and the South East, including from, you know, Hastings or even around Canterbury. And I think you put them in a completely different environment, and then you start to see all sorts of connections form, which, you know, my grandparents, for example, who grew up in Worcester and Cardiff respectively, but met in Newquay during the Second World War. My grandmother was in the Welsh, my father was in the RAF, my grandfather was in the RAF. And what then happened, of course, is that, you know, life changed irrevocably. So those family connections, I think, you know, there's all sorts of things which going to university kind of short-circuited in a way, you know, doing things at the age of 18, having come from, you know, I didn't choose the school I went to, my parents chose that, but suddenly this sort of autonomy, and you make friends, and in some cases sustain them, or as it would be interesting, maybe not. What would you say were your earliest memories? How far can you go back?
I have a very peculiar memory, as people know only too well, and I have a flashbulb memory, and it is from the age of one, and it is a very clear memory of myself sitting next to my brother, who is, as he used to do, is stretched out on the carpet and probably reading New Scientist or Scientific American. And the TV, we had a black and white TV, is playing, and it is quite plainly a picture of Roger Delgado addressing John Pertwee as a doctor. And so that's my first memory. I know that is correct, because several years later, I happened to see an episode of The Mind of Evil, that's the name of the story, and there was that scene on the screen. So I know exactly what it was, like sort of moment of you know, recognition, as it were. So that's my very, very earliest memory. So yes, most impressively, it is a science fiction related memory as well. But I think the most important thing, again, actually, is about people. So actually, what in a sense establishes the memory is actually the closeness between myself, my brother, in a kind of rather conventional posture, being stretched out on the carpet, TV on as well, and so it's that closeness in terms of the kind of family setting, the domestic setting, which sort of, I don't know, somehow kind of burnt that memory into my brain cells. My next memories are much more from, like, I think the age of three, four, I think, so there's a bit of a kind of gap there. And I think, again, they're going to be Doctor Who related memories, rather depressingly. TV plays a very, very large part of my early memory and childhood. That is mainly because my mother thought, my God, TV, what a fantastic device for entertainment and education. It was a wonderful kind of pedagogic tool. This meant, and because my brother's 8 years older than me, and my mother thought, okay, I can just, you know, leave Paul in the company of John, who'll look after him. John's tendency was, of course, to then get me to watch all sorts of TV very, very late at night. So I tended not to go to sleep until quite late. So, for example, at the age of four, I remember watching The Prisoner. And The Prisoner was being repeated last thing before close down on London weekend television, I think. So this would be about 11:30 at night. And I am still absolutely terrified by the very last episode of The Prisoner, which, again, very, very... You can see it now. I am number one. Anyway, and it's that burns stuff. So there's a lot of TV memories. So there's a great line in The Simpsons about where Bart and Lisa are kissing the TV, And Homer says, "Are you keeping the TV again?" "No, Dad," they explain. And the next line is like, "Oh, you know, the TV brought us up more than you ever did." You know, and it's that kind of feeling actually that TV had this very, very large part to play.
Well, I'm almost embarrassed. I've always kept a diary, and when I look at the diary from when I was 9 or 10 years old, it's all about, it's just a list, effectively, of the programs I watched. And but also what it does show is how, you know, actually things like I suppose you can watch these things now because you've got like Netflix or Amazon Prime, but it's all like, you know, each week it was the Carry On film, Saturday night, yes. 6 o'clock, you know, Carry On Girls or Carry On Up the Khyber. And, but Doctor Who, my goodness, when I was at school with my friends, we all used to act out. And this is the funny thing. There must have been one of those episodes, the Five Doctors, when they all came together. I think William Hartnell was dead at that point, so somebody played the role. But this was interesting. We all used to act out a different doctor. So I might be, I think, like John Pertwee. My friend might be Tom Baker. It was the days. This would have been around, yeah, Peter Davidson had just taken over. That is right, yeah. So Doctor Who, huge role. Actually, the Master, forget the Daleks or the Cybermen, the Master used to frighten me. I'd wake up in the night and I was convinced that they're like, I see a pattern on my curtains, and it was, I thinking, it's the Master, because he it's interesting what he did, because he was maybe that's kickstarted my interest in Christology, but the whole sort of human and divine. But you know, he was the more human, you know, he just looked sinister. Anthony Ainley, wasn't it? He really, there was something very chilling, even in the late 80s, when I was in school, fifth or sixth form, and it was when, would it been, not, who was after Colin Baker? Sylvester McCoy. Right. And it was the same actor playing the Master, and he still had that capacity freak me out.
I mean, I'm trying to remember things that see anything that kind of traumatic memories. Nothing really traumatic, actually. This is the bizarre thing. Some years ago, they were repeating I, Claudius on BBC Four, and I saw I, Claudius at the age of six, again with my brother completely abandoning any sense of responsibility towards me. And I watched those, but I don't remember those naked women there. So things obviously kind of went over my head, or you know, through my, but I still absolutely remember Sean Phillips' portrayal as Livia, you know, which is wonderfully kind of sinister, you know, sort of figure. So those kind of sinister figures I think stay in the memory very, very strongly, actually.
The embarrassment factor, I had that. I think it may have been Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, or there was something, actually with Tom Baker, but not Doctor Who, there was some quite dark drama, BBC, that he was in. And I remember walking in, it probably was only about 9:30, but I was inverted commas, supposed to be in bed, and I just come in, and my elder sister and my parents were watching this, and you could just see the embarrassment. It was like, I was only about, 14 or something like that at the time, and everybody was just like doing everything but... Yes. They weren't looking at me and they weren't looking at the TV.
Yeah.
They were just sort of thinking, this is a really embarrassing situation. How do we get out of this one? You know? So what stood out was not so much the nudity on the screen, but it was the responses to that.
Yes.
And what that said about our particular sort of, you know, British sort of, you know, we don't talk about these things.
Yes. I suspect because my mother worked in medicine, she didn't really bothered too much about. I mean, I remember watching Dennis Potter's Pennies from Heaven, you know. So, my mother didn't seem to be, okay, it's fine, dandy. So, she didn't seem to censor very much. She just seemed to rely on John, which is a very bad move, really. But, I didn't really have a problem with that, sort of nudity and things like that, What's interesting, in terms of kind of traumatic, the one traumatic memory I do remember, and I was reading this passage again, Mark Fisher's Ghosts of My Life, where the book starts off with the memory of the very final episode of Sapphire and Steel, which is a truly terrifying... I mean, interesting, within about a year of each other, we had two famously kind of shock endings to science fiction series. One is Blake Seven, where all the characters apparently get killed. And Sapphire and Steel, though, is worse, but where the two characters are trapped endlessly in a kind of time loop from which they can never escape. But when I read Mark's little piece about it in his book, it was actually strangely comforting to see that somebody else had actually been kind of traumatised by this at more or less the same age, and were then still able to like, sort of write through and try to exorcise that to some extent, but through the act of writing. So I was kind of strangely comforting to find other people.
Well, I actually found the same sort of fear, almost, I suppose, that came from, I think it was either Trumpton or Camberwick Green. Well, wait for this now. You know, at the end of the programme, when, or was it Windy Miller, they would go underground.
Oh, yes.
And there'd be like a hole in the ground would open up and disappear.
And descend.
It would descend into that, and then wouldn't come out again until the following episode, the following week. Again, I'm sure that sort of kick-started all this interest in Christology and hell. I do. Because, you know, I was really young, and it was just this thought of this creature, this character, with a big smile on his face, is now actually going to be subterranean for another 7 days. He comes up to 5 minutes a week, at, you know, 1:30 in the afternoon or 5:35 p.m. before the evening news or whatever it was. But, you know, I read too much into it. Actually, many years later, Teletubbies, I couldn't get it because as an adult, I was an adult at this point, and I could see this, you know, smiling face in the sky. And I was thinking, that would have really freaked me out if I was young. I was thinking, what's that baby doing up there? Yeah. It's going to be really hot, you know? He's alienated from all his friends or her friends. So it, for me, those things that are supposed to be sort of like good for children to watch, in some cases I responded to them in a very out of kilter sort of way,
that is true. Again, you do get that disconnection, the child imagination and the adult experience. I mean, Teletubbies is fine, but you know, tweeners are truly dreadful.
Actually, some years ago, I think it was about 1998, I recorded a film off the TV. It was coming up to Christmas, so 1998, December 98, BBC Two, and I set the video for 5 minutes before the film started, and it was the 64th film with Richard Attenborough about the abducting a child seance on a wet afternoon. Now, that's a not for me, to put that on at 10:30 in the morning. I think it's a PG rating, but it's about child abduction. It's about a woman who's lost a child, and she goes into the world of seances to kidnap a child, and then obviously they know more about the child than they care to admit, and then women who've you know, the mother of the abducted child, they will then sort of claim all sorts of, you know, things about what the child knows, and you know, we're never quite sure. It's not for commercial, it's not for monetary gain, but it seems to be some, you know, deep psychosis. And anyway, but that was on at 10:30 in the morning, so I set the video for 10:25, and it was the end of Teletubbies. And I was thinking, for a child to go from Teletubbies to seance on a wet afternoon, I mean, I was only about mid-20s at the time, but again, what a peculiar, you know, combination,
yes,
you know,
synchronicity. Really that one
So to go from Teletubbies for children to a film about the abduction of children, you know, daytime television. That,
yes.
But TV does frame all of our nostalgia in many cases. But I mean, for me, growing up, it was always the charts. It was always what's number one each week. Do you have any recollection musically? Were you particularly into what was musically out?
My earliest musical memory is ABBA winning Eurovision in 74. So I remember that very, very clearly. And I do remember Bohemian Rhapsody. Top of the Pops, so 75. So that's the beginnings about that point. Memories about music. When my brother went to Imperial College, he had access to the Haldane Library, and the Haldane Library had a particularly fine vinyl collection that he discovered. And so I was then kind of greedy with some rather strange records that John picked up from there. So it's probably that period when I sort of first sort of started hearing like Bob Dylan and Blood on the Tracks, I think, must have been something that John got from the Haldane Library. Frank Zappa's Freak Out generally freaked me out at the age of 10. Which actually is still very scary, actually, even now, in my view. That was quite scary. So I've got memories like that. The other memories are ones actually connected to John's fashion choices. Now, my brother has got somewhat eclectic choices in terms of fashion. But in sort of 70s, late 70s, you know, it was very much Led Zeppelin, and therefore long hair, and, you know, Led Zeppelin T-shirt. The moment he saw Gary Numan on Top of the Pop, suddenly it was all short hair and thin ties. So it's odd, I can map things onto how John looks as well, actually. These were probably deterrents to how I would look later. So when Bowie went into his kind of, you know, sort of, serious moonlight phase, John suddenly became Bury-like, which always meant sort of not eating and being emaciated. So I kind of played off a lot from the memories that actually.
No, it was the same here, because one of my earliest memories of Top of the Pops is Adamant and the video for Stand and Deliver.
Oh, yes.
With what, like the Tippex on the face, you know?
Yes, indeed. Okay. Yep.
And the other was Bucks Fizz. Now, the other Eurovision, the time when obviously Britain won in 81 with Making Your Mind Up. Mm. And that had a big influence as well with the, you know, the whole pulling the skirts off and everything. But that was something that really struck a chord. Eurovision. When you're really young.
I wonder why.
But again, would you get away with it now? I mean, it was extraordinary, really. But I see that now, I feel very uncomfortable because it's sort of like, it's okay, the men just rip off the skirts. But that, but you know, 7 or 8 years of age, that, you know, made a huge impression.
Well, early 80s, I'm thinking, I mean, you know, this is, I wasn't supposed to say it's something remember this also the era of mini pops on Channel 4, where it seems to be okay to, you know, little girls, you know, miming along to the hits of the day and very, very heavily painted up. And
I remember they showed that a few years ago, and it was one of those sort of, you know, most embarrassing TV moments. Mm. And there are some TV moments that are embarrassing because something unexpected happens and an interview goes disastrously wrong. Mm. But this was a programme, a commissioned programme, which obviously lasted for several months. I don't know, what was it, like 80, 81, 82, that sort of period, yeah. 80s,
yeah.
And you're absolutely right. So you've got young, really young girls dressed completely, you know, as... you know, Madonna or whatever, but in ways that, you know, they are clearly prepubescent.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I remember Tracy Ullman did a comedy sketch, and that's like Three of a Kind, so satirizing mini pops. So it was obviously people knew that, this is not quite right even then, you know. So yeah, that's a dodgy thing. Yeah, I suppose musical memories. I mean, I always claim that I can remember Bill Grundy's interview with the Sex Pistols. In 76, because it was kind of primetime TV. I always claim that, but I'm a little bit, you know, I haven't, sort of not too sure. That's a bit too hazy. But certainly, watching the Algorithm Test, late 70s, and then through the 80s, so kind of punk was, oddly enough, something was there, actually, in the background. So that was an interesting thing. And then, of course, you've got the New Romantics and so forth.
Even now, whenever I hear John Lydon, isn't it, who's being interviewed, I always back in my mind think, is this going to go the same way as that 1976 interview?
There we go. But sadly not.
Yeah, no.
It'd probably be more likely sort of selling you butter or something.
Yeah, yes.
Now music became very important as a kind of. Not a tribal marker, because I wasn't sort of with anybody at that time, but, you know, obviously later at grammar school, yes, it became a way of kind of bonding with people, but also a way of delineating between myself and my brother as well. So that became very important. So music as a kind of something around which I could form my identity became very important. So although I didn't sort of discover John Peel until a bit later, John Peel used to, at that time, in the start of the 80s, was still like broadcasting like, you know, 4 or 5 days a week, and there was always this kind of scary thing about John Peel. I always felt that he was this rather sort of guy. He always seemed to rather grumpy on Top of the Pops, frankly. And they always had this image of John Peel in a darkened studio playing goodness only knows what records. So I was sort of a little bit intimidated when listening to John Peel, but until about 1985, and then finally kind of plucked up the courage, as it were, and I got rather regretted not having listened to him.
I enjoyed watching all those old Top of the Pops, you know, which are still shown on BBC 4.
Yes.
And around 1982, he did loads of them. Yep. And it was interesting because he'd always, you know, speak in this really, you know, clearly slightly, you know, he'd feign the enthusiasm.
Yes, indeed.
Like, not the music he'd play on his 10 p.m. show. But what I thought was really funny and illuminating is Dollar. A lot. But he actually said, you know, that his children, who were very young at the time, I think maybe his daughter was a real fan, and mm-hmm. and actually in a funny way it felt authentic, that it was more like, it's not his music, but he gets it.
Yes.
And I thought, fair play to him. He was kind of like playing along with it.
Yeah, but you got to remember, I mean, Peely was also a Eurovision fan, and he was actually the first DJ to play Sheena Easton on Radio 1. So,
which song was that? Do you know?
Must be not.
Morning Train, or that
no,
one?
No, 9 to 5.
He played that.
Yes. Yes, no, I know this because when he was doing the Pillennium, so basically he's run down the entire 20th century. When he got about 81, there was Sheena Easton being played. So there you go.
Well, Sheena Easton now, I heard her being interviewed recently. It's funny because she grew up in Glasgow, but she lost her accent. She moved to, she spent some time in Las Vegas, I think, didn't she? And she was at one point, you know, quite big with Prince. And,
yes,
but her accent is should we politely call transatlantic?
Indeed.
But occasionally you see hear a little bit of the Glaswegian. But you know, I find her fascinating. You know, as a case study.
Yes, again, she was like invented by.
But she was Esther Ransom.
Yes, the big time.
That's incredible. Yeah. But what inspired you then to enter academia? Because obviously all these influences, you mentioned sci-fi so far, some of the musical, you mentioned grammar school, but how did you end up in this profession?
I ended up in academia. As I always say, I kind of stumbled into academia. And then the old line is, not too short to pack shelves. So I kind of ended up going to Oxford Brookes University, or Oxford Polytechnic, and it was then when I first started. So I just about had enough A-levels to get in at that point. And I had no particular expectation that I would do... I mean, if I got a 2-2, I'd been very happy, frankly, because I'd been far better than anything my teachers would have expected me to achieve. And it was a lecture on structuralism in my first year, delivered by Ron Hammond. I mean, just towards the end of the lecture, he talked about Roland Barthes. I went, and I thought, that's what I used to think about, ooh, in my teen years, and my teachers thought I was an idiot. And there was that moment, this is fascinating. So, so critical theory has come my way into sort of loving university, I suppose. So but again, it wasn't until about halfway through my second year that I thought, actually, you know what, I might stay on and do an MA, you know. And I came back to Kent to my master's. It was then mentioned that you can apply for funding to a PhD, you know, British Academy. I went, oh, okay, fine, I'll put the funding in. And I didn't expect to get funded, and I was then astonished that I was funded. So I then ended up doing a PhD on the short story for like the next 4 or 5 years. But then at the end of my PhD, I kind of did a little bit of part-time teaching, but I was actually mainly working in London. Then I kind of got dragged back into, or lured back into the possibility of more teaching. What inspired me then was actually kind of guilt. I actually hadn't done anything with my PhD. My mother died a couple of years earlier, and it was kind of a sense of unfulfillment and a mix of guilt. And I thought I'd really better give this a crack, at least for a year or two, and see how it goes. What I didn't expect was that I would actually then meet my partner. What I didn't expect less was that my partner would then be diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and would spend more than a year in hospital. So that point of actually leaving academia to something else, kind of, I'd better stay here, and so then I kind of stayed here. And then I stayed here, and I stayed here. And that's kind of how it is. There was no kind of grand plan. Whereas, again, my brother, when I was going through my mother's papers after death, my mother actually kept a kind of flow chart that John had drawn out when he was about 16 or something, and he'd actually plotted out exactly his course to where he is now at Oxford, and in my case it was just a complete
mess. He had an academic career as well.
He's Professor of Theoretical Physics at New College, Oxford. Sounds awfully grand. He's got all the sciences and I've got all the arts. So there we go. His plan is very linear and directed, and therefore more successful. And in my case, mine was kind of like stumbling around and swerving and kind of crashing into things, and then stuff happening and developing from there. But there was no grand master plan. I suppose I'd kind of. Obviously, my brother being 80 years older, so when I was 10, he'd already started at Imperial. So there's, oh, yes, universities, that's a thing. Okay, that's the thing that could go, okay. And I think also the thing that, another again, talking about sort of nudity, The History Man on TV. So we're going to show that, which is probably designed to make, no, academics can be very nasty people sometimes, but at least in Malcolm Bradbury's world. And but actually, no, it's Anthony Sher, and he's really sexy. So it kind of made academia look, that's quite interesting. So I don't know, I sort of thought that maybe university is a thing that you could do, as it were. But I didn't know I'd be doing it for as long as I have.
No, and there is that thing called imposter syndrome where, in my case, I've got a sister who's also an academic, and but similar sort of background. She's a classicist, but part of her degree was also theology, so that when we both went to Lampeter, so we have that in common. But in my case, I certainly didn't think that I'd have a career here, because you know, going to university was such an important thing. It was almost sort of, you know, I can't believe I'm here, and then here I am now. That I'm teaching students who were born in many cases several years after I graduated. In fact, I got my PhD in 99, and the students I'm teaching now were born around that period. So sometimes not having a plan, I mean, I suppose there almost came a point for me where, having got my BA, then my master's and the PhD, it was almost inevitable, perhaps, that at least I'd be looking for work in the sector, because if you're going to become that qualified in a specialised area, the dream that I always had, which was to do something in radio, kind of thought, well, that's great, but it's not so much I'm overqualified, I have qualifications in an area that are not going to be suitable for sitting in a radio studio. So it's more the sense that having tasted academia and in a sense, you know, having the knack for that, it just became something that fell into place. Well, but wasn't the original dream?
No, I mean I think when I went to Oxford Books, I kind of thought again actually radio, because we've not discussed that actually radio is a huge aspect of my life as well, and I think that's what I kind of wanted to do, maybe to kind of work in radio, actually radio producer. I always rather liked the idea of radio production. I never really wanted to be like sort of, you know, in front of the microphone. I kind of wanted to be behind the scenes, as it were, you know, pulling the strings. So I kind of wanted to be there. And so everything kind of went a bit pear-shaped and took me away from those things. And, you know, in my sort of naive moments, I still thought, oh, I could be radio four controller, I'll get it right, you know. But radio production would have been the thing I'd have done, really. So it may have been something involving communication and, you know, and sort of, you know, and some notions of dissemination, articulation. So it just happened I ended up being academic. But then I kind of think of myself as more of a storyteller than an academic, really, which is how my seminars tend to be structured. So, that idea of narrative, I think, is quite important. Yeah.
Well, if the university closes, then obviously you can be my producer. We can do we can pair up. This is the dream team.
Well, that is the dream team, absolutely. You know, this is exactly what the university should be doing. They should be giving us grants to establish this as a viable project, frankly. Yeah. That's exactly what should be happening.
There we are. Well, I hope the right people are listening.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, in my case, I voted for the first time while I was at university. In your case, would it have been the same election? It was 92 in my case.
Yes, 92. Yeah. 92.
How big a role has politics played in your life?
Well, I mean, I'm opposition in that I'm not a party political person. I've never been part of a political party. I've never joined in a political campaign. And yet I did study politics in my first year at university. And I am certainly kind of politically motivated. It's not a case of I don't want anything to do with politics, because politics quite plainly has a lot to do with us, frankly, which I'm paraphrasing somebody there. But again, I've never had a kind of, you know, I'm a party person and a kind of sense of absolute party loyalty. So 92, I voted Liberal Democrat in 92, although I regret not voting Labour, frankly. I have to say, in hindsight. But then my, you know, how I voted has shifted around. Never the Tories. There you go. But it has kind of shifted around a bit, actually. My family was a kind of traditional Conservative Party supporting family. So, a kind of working class Toryism, as it were. But there and there again, my mother, I think she also voted Lib Dem in 92 as well, because of the changes in the NHS. And thereafter, and then she didn't vote in 97. She refused.
Mm. Yes, actually, the NHS played a big role in that campaign. I've still got recollections of Jennifer's Ear, which was Robin Cook and William Waldegrave. That's just come back to me now. And there was a little bit of a showdown between the two of them in the run-up to the election. Yeah. But, you know, it's funny, because I remember a decade later, when I was living in Ceredigion, we had a by-election, and nobody seemed all that interested. I remember the students probably didn't, in many cases, didn't vote. But back then, a lot of the parties were occupying the centre ground. My sense now, of course, and certainly after Brexit, is that students really are, I mean, for me, what was really apparent in the 2017 election was the students on campus where there was a polling station queuing up at, you know, 2 or 3 in the afternoon. I walked past them. I saw it on the Guardian, on the pod cam, and I saw the students at Kent, and I thought, you know, is this exaggerated? Did they do this just for the cameras? No, it was true. I walked past. I just went over to the shop to get something to eat. And this excitement that the election generated, no other election. I mean, for me, 92 was a big thing because it was the first time I voted. But that sort of level of enthusiasm or engagement, I have never seen since.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, actually. I think students have become more politicised. And, you know, again, I think that's understandable in terms of the ways in which students are having to pay so much more for their degrees. And I think that's, you know, I think once people's purses are being squeezed, then I think people have become more radicalised in terms of the politics. I think it's a kind of general point being made there, really. So that doesn't really surprise me. I mean, certainly kind of growing up, you know, for me, I mean, obviously with my dates of birth, you know, I kind of fall into the kind of Generation X camp. And so, you know, allegedly we're all meant to be kind of politically apathetic and slackers and so on and so on. And actually, yeah, partially it's true. I think it's not true to say that Generation X was totally non-political. Even political apathy could be a kind of political choice. But I don't think students are as apathetic as they were. If that was true, again, I think that's a bit of, you know, ambiguity there, frankly. But I think students are much more keen to vote and keen to get involved in campaigns. Again, I think, you know, if we see that during the time of the university strike.
Yes, and certainly I remember talking to mature students 15 years ago who was one in West Wales where I used to teach, and she said that when she did her first degree back in the 60s, then everybody was at, you know, students were actively involved in the issues of the day. And she said students these days have just lost that appetite. But I agree. I think that has been rekindled.
I think it's been rekindled.
Yeah. And then the question which, as a religious studies lecturer, we would never ask our students doing religious studies, about people's religious backgrounds or persuasions. But did religion have any important role to play in your growing up?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. In growing up, my mother was agnostic. My brother is an atheist. I have a very deep memory, though, probably about 9 years old, watching, it's like during those sort of Easter holidays, and watching very cheap, kind of like, so it was like not animated, it's basically just still pictures on screen. Paul Copley actually was reading, the Easter story, and being very, very moved by this, and that's kind of there. During the time of my teen years, being the kind of arrogant adolescent that I was militantly atheistic. And then that changed as an undergraduate. And it, where it changed was kind of gradually on various things, but particularly when I was doing a module on late 18th, 19th century British society, and particularly looking at the world of madness, and discovering the extent to which Quaker groups had played a very pivotal role in improving the welfare of the mad, as it were. So the first kind of proper sort of, as it were, kind of caring establishments for the mad were Quaker groups like the Cheap Retreat. And so that realisation of, hold a minute, an atheistic or a secular, or not necessarily atheistic, that wouldn't be quite true by the early 19th century, but a secular science, should I say, broadly speaking. Oh, that's the kind of weak point here, that Christianity has actually played a huge part. And then that kind of softened my views. And so I, having not so good appetite, I probably came, you know, if I was still kind of atheistic then, but kind of became more agnostic in the 90s and sort of became more open and kind of much more open to other kind of belief systems. So the kind of a general kind of softening of things. Well, this is most most interesting is when we are 2018. So 2 years ago, I was baptised, and so I'm now baptised at the Church of England, and I occasionally take communion when I'm not looking after children. And suddenly, how I necessarily would be able to exactly process my religious beliefs or not is still somewhat indistinct and unclear.
Yeah, I was actively involved in my local church when I was growing up. I used to serve in my local parish church. But when I went to university to study theology, what I found is that a lot of the students who were involved in the chapel, which originally I thought I'd be actively involved in as a continuation of those pre-university interests, were much more on the evangelical wing. And in many cases, they were not studying, as I was, theology or religious studies. Yeah. And so I didn't feel the same sort of connection. Yeah. And in some cases, I was aware that there was perhaps a perceived fissure between doing a degree in theology and some of the issues there. Well, there was often an assumption that because I was studying theology, that in some ways I must have a clear view on a particular moral position. And in some cases, I found that uncomfortable because it was starting from scratch. It was for me saying, okay, rather than in a sermon type scenario, learning the Christian message, let me go to Karl Barth, let me go to Rudolf Bultmann, let me go back to basics. And for me, I found that all my energies were channeled into that academic pursuit. And in a way, that's never gone away. So religion fascinates me. And of course, now that I teach it, I'm extremely careful, obviously, in terms of ensuring that we are as inclusive as possible. We obviously have students who are very happy to divulge their religious predilections, and in some cases those who don't, or in many cases I would say probably majority of students are perhaps agnostic. That would just be a guess, but that's anecdotal. We often have students though who'll put up their hand and say, I'm not religious, but, and I thought, you get a whole article out of that, it is the elephant in the room sometimes.
I was one of a total of four or five students who studied RE O level, despite my so-called atheism in the 80s. I think I tend to be a very spiritual person, and that was always there as a child, and it sort of come to manifest itself in various different ways, and it's just something that became more solid in my mid-40s. But it's not necessarily any link back to any kind of earlier childhood experience, because I just didn't have those experiences. But it's almost in that case, because there was a lack, that it somehow becomes shaping in some sense. And maybe a kind of general feeling about, where is the role of the spiritual or the religious within contemporary society, and kind of feeling actually, I kind of like, even though if someone was to press me, do you believe in God? Let me think about that one. Nevertheless, I do need to actually stake out a position here, So becoming baptised was my way of doing that, but it was kind of odd as well. but I have to say it hasn't really affected my teaching, because my teaching was always very much based on kind of inclusivity. And kind of just balancing out. I remember one class. So this is all good 10 years ago, 10 years at least now, where I knew that I had one student who was definitely, I could tell, was strongly kind of Christian, another student very militantly atheist, and kind of balancing out so nobody's views are being silenced, equally nobody's having total say, you know, and trying to do that. So trying to be very inclusive was always been kind of my watchword, as it were. Just to be able to kind of show respect more than anything, actually. But yeah.
I always find whenever we're looking at Richard Dawkins, the response there, because of course Dawkins, I've had at least one, I think actually two students in the time that I've been teaching. So I think once at Kent and once in my previous job in the University of Wales, who wrote to Richard Dawkins and said, "Oh, we're studying you in our class on religion and science. Would you like to offer some thoughts?" And his response was, "Well, you know, in many cases, you know, you're studying something which isn't true." But of course, I'm caricaturing perhaps, but although Dawkins himself does that rather well himself, but I found that the students didn't recognise the way in which there was that perception that, you know, why are you studying religion? And for me, that's probably why a lot of my work is in the methodology of religion. Mm. But that assumption that, you know, if you're studying something, it must be because in some way you're a proselytizer, you know, you're teaching. But also the reasons that we might study religion have got nothing to do with wanting to promote a particular type of religious experience. But it is peculiar sometimes that is the caricature. Yeah. And I was saying that in the first interview, that sometimes I do find outside of the academic setting, where generally there is an expectation and an assumption that you're studying something, for good, wholesome educational purposes, that outside sometimes there is that assumption that if you're studying, you know, religion, then in some way that says something about your particular character. And I've been in pubs before where somebody, you know, once was horrified that I was working in a department of theology and religious studies, and I was doing my PhD at the time, and yet I was not a regular churchgoer, and I was accused of being a false person. And that really stuck with me, the idea that, you know, I think the assumption must have been that if I was studying religion, then in some way that must have been an extension of a wider sort of framework.
I think that is interesting, actually, because I think, you know, even sort of stepping away from the religious to secular, I remember one of my undergraduate tutors who was presenting a paper on Grace Nichols. So my tutor's white, English, talking about a black African-American poet, and one of the sort of delegates, one of the in the audience, who herself was black, was "I'm very surprised that you yourself are not black." You know, why would it be a case that you'd only if you were going to be presenting on a black woman's writer, you would have therefore to be at least, you know, black yourself? It's very strange, you know. But you know, it raises those issues about kind of, you know, that what you write must be somehow connected to who you are or what you believe, and that seems to be a very kind of caricatured way of thinking about academic discourse, the practice of academia, academic thought. So it seems a rather peculiar thing to do there. You know, having said that, I remember the comedian Sally Phillips, who is Christian, and I remember she was once saying radio on I must be like loose ends. Somebody went to say, when she was playing Inspector the Pony, and somebody like sympathised with, it must be so hard for you to writing those, saying those rude words. And so I was thinking, well, actually, I wrote those sketches, you know. So it's very odd that people tend to think you must be an extension of your beliefs.
Although, actually, what comes to mind actually is Anne Widdecombe, the other great comedian of our time, who on Have I Got News for You? When it was clear that they were trying to get her to say things, which they knew that she would be very uncomfortable saying, and I think, I'm not sure who was squirming more, the audience at home,
it kind of backfired. I don't.
We'll pass on that one. Yeah.
I don't know. I suddenly feel very sympathetic to anybody.
But I did think her novel, the Clematis Tree, was actually far better. I mean, Ian Hislop actually recommended it. So there we are, some years ago. But last couple of questions: would you say that you have fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young? In a way, we've touched on that already. But in terms of where you are now, if you could go back to your undergraduate self, and you could see what you're doing now, what would that 20-year-old self be thinking?
My undergraduate self would very probably be thinking that in academia one can liberate thought, and we'll enter into a kind of utopia, basically an extension of a kind of left bank Parisian Gaulois smoking scene, really. And this would be paradise. And I'd be telling my 20-year-old self, I'm an idiot, frankly. That's not what academia is there at all, and certainly what the modern university is there at all for. I'd probably be disillusioning my. I'd be very disillusioned. Oh yes, I'm now. I'd be disillusioning my 20-year-old self. Have I fulfilled things? I don't know. On the one hand, I've achieved things I could never have possibly expected. So, for example, when I come to a university library and I want to work out the catalogue, how to work out the catalogue, I type in things to do with science fiction. Aha. And I came here to Kent, you could do that, and I was very surprised to discover that, there's a lot of copies of Foundation and Extrapolation knocking around here. That instead was a new thing to me. My goodness, there are academic journals on science fiction. Most bizarre. To think that 25 years later I should be the editor of Foundation is an extraordinary thought, and one that kind of gives me goosebumps. This is a bit name dropping, the fact that I could be, about a week ago be sat next to John Clute, a great sort of eminence figure within science fiction criticism, the fact that about 4 months or so from now I should be hopefully introducing M. John Harrison in the Centre for Creative Writing to give a reading, that's just not even possible, frankly. So on the one sense, no, I probably haven't fulfilled things I would have wanted to achieve. Does anyone? On the other hand, I've achieved things that I could never possibly have expected, let alone having two children would be just the most extraordinary thought. And I'll get all very John Pill here and start getting weepy about my children, but I won't do that. It's a mixture of things there.
My very, very last question then is, would you say that you were a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Now, I thought about that question because I saw it on a list and I would debate it with myself. I think probably because of growing up in Gillingham, which is not exactly the... don't get ideas in Gillingham, frankly. I think I've always had a sort of... it's going to be a long answer, sorry. On the one hand, I've always been a very optimistic person. I tend to be optimistic for other people. So I always tend to think, slightly paraphrased the great line from Kafka, there is infinite hope, just not for us. And I've always said, just not for me. So I've always been very optimistic for other people, but I can be quite pessimistic about myself. Having said that, certainly during the course of the 90s, I was quite a relatively forward-looking person. I think a big shock to me was the death of my mother, because I was so close after my viva for my PhD. So that, I think, had a big sort of seismic effect. I think where I've become more of a backward-looking person was simply to come about that moment you mentioned earlier of teaching students who are substantially younger than myself. So this would have occurred in about the mid-noughties, about 2006, where I was teaching for the School of English back then, actually, for Don DeLillo's Mao Tu. And Don DeLillo's Mao Tu is a novel which is structured around a series of historical events in the year that DeLillo was writing the novel. And one of those events is the Hillsborough tragedy. And because I tend to have a break halfway through my seminars, one of the students came up to me and said, very politely, I'm sorry, but what happened to Hillsborough? I mean, she'd never even heard of this. And I thought, well, okay, I'll explain. Fair enough. And then I thought, well, why would she know? She would have been only 4 years old at the time. So very, that's one of the, and that moment of realizing that actually I have become living history. And there's too much you can go about that. I can go, oh, woe is me. No, I am really, really ancient. Or you can say, ah, no, actually, this is an opportunity to actually teach. You know, and I say, okay, yes, my life story has become part of history. And it's not just a series of cliches or nostalgic kind of, you know, reflections that actually becomes part of a vital living culture which we can transmit to our students. And so, yes, I am backward-looking, because that's what I do an awful lot of time. And I think because I went to university to study history means I think I've always been a very backward-looking person. But there's a kind of backward-lookingness in order then to pass on stuff to the next generation. So there's a kind of forward-lookingness as well, which kind of frames all of that. So it's probably a bit of both. There you go. Politicians answered your question.
No, fantastic food for thought. There we are. Many thanks, Paul Mark Russell.
Thank you.